Our next speaker, well, I think you've recognized her already. For most of you, I don't even need to tell you about her. For 14 years, she was at the helm of our union. Well, time goes by, and some of you haven't had a chance to meet her. So I would just like to say a few things about Judy Darcy. She has been an activist since, back then when I was still in diapers, I think. So, well, really, I'm sorry about that, but I just like to underscore this. She has a great number. She has years of experience. Well, I'm sure she'll get back to me for that comment. So anyway, Judy, thanks for all those years in which you've helped us. So I'll say nothing else. Here she is, Judy Darcy.
She says she was in diapers. I was trying to lift her and rock her in her cradle. It is so incredible to be here. C'est un grand plaisir d'être ici.
It is a great pleasure for me to be here with you.
Incredible conference, hasn't it? Une conférence merveilleuse. It is very emotional for me to be speaking to you here today. I have to say, people say you're nervous. How can you be nervous? You've spoken like tens of thousands of times in your life, which is true. But it is the first time I've had the chance to speak to a conference of CUPE since I retired. That's the best word for now. Retired 5.5 years ago. And so it is very emotional because this room and this conference for me is also full of memories of sisters and brothers with whom we took on so many struggles for equality over the years. And I can't tell you how excited I am to be in a room here with you today and to have the opportunity to speak about an issue that is so near and dear to my heart. Those memories, actually, she says, when she was in diapers. Well, the memories actually go back to the very first CUPE National Convention I ever attended, which was right here in this hotel in the year 1973. I'm glad there was a collective gasp in the room. That's what you're supposed to do. But I do also want to be very clear that child labor was still legal when I first became an activist in the Canadian Union of Public Employees. Actually, that's not so funny because child labor is now legal again in British Columbia, so we don't actually crack jokes about it there. But as I think back over the struggles that women have been through and equality-seeking groups have been through in this union, through the 60s, through the 70s, through the 80s, through the 90s, and up until when we speak, as I listen to the women who spoke at the panel the first evening in particular, there are several thoughts that keep running through my mind, and one of them is that it's so clear that every generation of women has to take on and fight the struggle for equality for themselves. But it's also very, very clear to me as I listen and I learn that there are lessons from our history. There are common ingredients for success in our struggles. There are some guiding principles, if you will, that are absolutely critical to our success. And those are the things I've been asked to talk about today. And I want to start by talking about the question of women's leadership and how we build women's leadership in our union and in the trade union movement. You know, when I was listening to the panel the first evening, didn't they blow your socks off? Weren't they amazing? Those are going to live with me for a long time. As I was listening to them speak, I was also sort of going back to the last few national conventions, both in the fights for seats for women on the National Executive Board, but also going back many years before that, this fight for designated seats for a First Nations person and for a worker of color. And I was remembering people standing up on convention floors and saying, you know, we don't need special seats, that's discrimination. People should be elected strictly based on merit. And if women can't get there on merit, they shouldn't be there at all. And I thought to myself, I want those people in this room listening to that panel this first night. Would there be any doubt that there are women of incredible merit at all levels of this union, from right across the country, who can hold any leadership position if we decide that it will be so? One of the things that also struck me as I listened to the women on that panel and to women in the last couple of days is that women's leadership doesn't often develop the same way as the leadership of men does. Women's leadership develops through struggles. It develops through fighting for equality. It develops through standing up for our sisters and our brothers in the workplaces. It develops through education in action. We don't have many of those old boys' networks that have existed in the trade union movement since, well, the beginning of the trade union movement. But how we build our skills, how we build our confidence, I've seen it through history. It's building women's leadership through struggles. I remember it very well in the pay equity battles in the 1980s, where both in the fights for pay equity, for legislation and pay equity plans in our collective agreements, women grew and developed in those struggles, but also when school board secretaries in Prince Edward Island or Ontario got equality in their pay with caretakers, you know, they walked around with a little bit more confidence and stride in their step, eh? They said, you know what? We are equal. We've been recognized. We saw it with, and I was reminded of this talking to Betty Jean Stevenson, we were reminded of this when women in the early 90s in Nova Scotia, we had a task force about violence against women in nursing homes, and they took their stories right across this province, that province, saying, you know what, violence isn't just part of the job. We can say no, we have to say it's not part of the job, and they grew in leadership and in stature. It happened in Quebec when women fought in our municipal locals in the city of Montreal for access to non-traditional jobs and begun to win them. And it has happened all through our history. There are endless examples up for women's wages in the early 2000, 2002, whatever, when our court stenographers in New Brunswick went on strike saying, up with women's wages, and our home support workers in Toronto fought for benefits for part-time workers. And it is certainly true today. I can see it in our own union, in the HEU, how women grow and develop when they're part of campaigning for a living wage or on our bargaining committees fighting for themselves and their co-workers. And it is certainly true of how women in our history have achieved the highest positions in our union. Going back to Grace Hartman, who was elected as the first woman to lead a national or international union in Canada back in 1975, she started by fighting for clerical workers, for women workers in North York City Hall, and became the first woman to lead a union in this country. She built her leadership strength and her skills through those struggles. And you know what? I started in the women's movement before I was even in the trade union movement, walking picket lines for immigrant women workers, fighting for reproductive choice, crashing beauty contests as an undercover protest candidate. And then in the trade union movement, being involved in bargaining and leading a first strike in 1975. And I absolutely believe that women's leadership is not about being solo players. It's not about fighting for ourselves and pulling up the ladder behind us. It's about opening the doors for other women. And the issue of building women's leadership at all levels of the union is integrally linked with building women's leadership in bargaining for equality. So what does that mean for us sisters and brothers? You know, many of us have worn buttons in our time that say, a woman's place is in the union. Well, I think we need a new button. A woman's place is on our bargaining committees, isn't it? Provincial, sectoral, regional, and local. Women need to be on those bargaining committees. It's absolutely critical to winning our agenda for equality, and it's absolutely critical to building women's leadership and power, as Gloria said the first night, not influence, but power at all levels of the union. And so often, and I'm sure you know the story well, women do all kinds of roles in the local. They're on executives, they're on committees of various sorts, but somehow being on the bargaining committee is often seen as being more traditionally men's work. More traditionally men's work. That's true in the Hospital Employees Union. We have 85% women in our membership, but when we come to our wage policy conference and we elect our bargaining committee, 85% women, 5 men, 5 women elected. And as far as the occupational groups represented, 6% of our members are skilled trades, 40% on the bargaining committee were skilled trades, with clerical workers, people who work in patient care, very much underrepresented. But I can tell you they learned a lesson. I think the women in HEU from that last round of bargaining, and we see the clerical workers out organizing for recognition, and the care aides and the LPNs out organizing for recognition, and there's no doubt in my mind they're going to be putting their issues front and center on the bargaining table in 2010, as I know so many of you will be across the country. How many women in this room are on local executives or on a local committee? Okay. How many women in the room are on bargaining committees? Okay, well, we're doing pretty well. We're doing very, very well. That is exceptional. Well, we know what we have to do, sisters and brothers. We know what we have to do, and you know, while we're at running and getting elected to bargaining committees, let's also do something about smashing those stereotypes about what it takes to be a good negotiator, shouldn't we? In order to get even more women involved, that being a good negotiator is not about whether you can swear like a trooper, how hard you can pound your fist, how much you can puff up and beat your chest, and how often you can threaten to hit the bricks. Although, you know, we know how to do that too. First and foremost, sisters, and being on a bargaining committee should not have to be an endurance test, where what we're tested by is how many hours we can go through the night. Let's be a little bit more family friendly, shouldn't we, about negotiations. A little bit more family-friendly and woman-friendly. Because you know what being a good negotiator is about, first and foremost? Being a good negotiator is about listening. It's about building consensus. It's about solving problems. It's about involving members. And it's about thinking strategically. And you know what, sisters? We know how to do all those things, don't we? We're really good at all of those things. Second ingredient for success that I'd like to talk about, and I want to pick up on some things that Armin talked about. Second ingredient for success, I think, is thinking strategically and fighting smart when we fight for equality. That's always important in anything that we do. But it is especially important right now in the economic context in which we're working. You know, the first night of the conference, several speakers spoke very eloquently about the tough economic times that we're living in. One person after another said very clearly, we didn't create this crisis and they shouldn't be able to solve it on our backs. Other people said, you know, Employers and governments say there's no money for equality rights now, but you know what? They weren't exactly prepared to fork over the cash in good times, were they? So why should we accept it now? And I agree with those sentiments 100%. We cannot allow, we should not allow, and we will not allow this current economic crisis to allow employers or to allow our unions at all levels to make excuses or to cop out from taking on the fight for equality. But having said that, what equality gains we fight for and how we fight for those equality gains does have to take into account the circumstances in which we're living, the economic crisis that will be the worst of any that any of us in our generations, have lived through. But you know, we've always recognized through our fight for women's wages, raising women's wages, for instance, that there isn't just one way to raise women's wages. We've raised women's wages by bringing up the bottom. We've raised women's wages by getting pay equity legislation. We've raised women's wages by bargaining pay equity plans. We've done it by bargaining job evaluation plans. We've done it in a wide, wide variety of ways, raising the base rates, fighting for benefits, fighting for pensions so that women don't have to retire into a life of poverty. There is no one single way to fight to raise women's wages, and there is no single way to move ahead on our bargaining agenda for social and economic equality. I firmly believe that there are opportunities. And Armin spoke about that, some of our panelists the first night did. I absolutely believe that there are opportunities for equality gains, even in the midst of this horrific economic crisis, and that we have to seize those opportunities. We have to identify those opportunities by thinking and analyzing strategically, and we have to seize them by fighting smart. And we also have to lay the groundwork in these very difficult times for how we achieve even greater gains for equality in the future, by building our coordinated bargaining structures, by building our women's committees, by strengthening our alliances in the communities at all levels. So what are those opportunities to make gains for equality? Of course, they vary. There is no cookie cutter. There is no single recipe. There are many recipes, and they vary from province to province, from sector to sector, often from local to local. We're heading into public sector bargaining in British Columbia in 2010, and we haven't done any surveys of our members yet, but I certainly know what they're saying to us already loud and clear. Number one issue: protect decent family supporting jobs for women. Job security, number one issue. And I want all of you to know that when we go into bargaining in 2010 in the Hospital Employees Union, because of that tremendous Supreme Court victory that we won almost 2 years ago now, that said they couldn't strip our collective agreement rights of the right to negotiate job security. When we go into bargaining in 2010, we will no longer be bargaining with one hand tied behind our back, and there's no doubt that job security will be the number one issue. What else are we hearing? Protect our benefits. Protect our benefits. Governments and employers, as you know, are gunning for them. They tried with us last time. They weren't successful. And with the massive loss of jobs in forestry and now in construction in our province, those benefits are absolutely critical for families, not just for the women, the predominantly women workforce in healthcare. And the kinds of concessions they will try and wring from us, as they did last time, are absolutely detrimental to women. Flexible benefits, cafeteria-style benefits, two-tier benefits that ultimately will be most damaging for women with families who all have to rely on their benefit plans. Number three, and Carol Kenzie spoke about this from the floor yesterday, more money for skills training and job training for women in the workforce. Absolutely critical. Absolutely critical, I think, for women members. Last time we negotiated a fund of $5 million under the control of the union to be able to have our members be able to advance skills training and skills upgrading opportunities. This was one of those where the employer decided and government decided they had a common interest with us. And our financial secretary, Denise Bernardo, tells me that by the time we get to 2010, over a four-year period, over 1,200 of our members will have taken part in that skills development training. And this is very much about women often who are in entry-level jobs being able to move into other occupations throughout healthcare. And just as you heard when they spoke about the representative workforce agreement in Saskatchewan for Aboriginal people, this is also very much about creating opportunities for people, for all equity-seeking groups in entry-level jobs to be able to pursue other career paths throughout healthcare in British Columbia. So we're very excited about it. It's one of the most popular things amongst our members. There's no doubt it will be a huge priority. Shift scheduling that responds to family needs. We've all talked about work-life balance. Our folks are also saying, you know, what about a little work-life balance for union activists? What about some more union leave so women don't have to continue to carry a triple burden of work and family and union activism? Violence in the workplace, it's escalating, especially in social services, especially in seniors care, as the quality of care and the staffing levels go down. It's our worker, our members on the front line who become the victims of violence. And I could go on. Our members have already got a pretty clear idea of some of the things that they want us to fight for in public sector bargaining in 2010, and I have no doubt that we will. The third and final issue that I want to talk to you about today is the issue of raising the wages of low-wage workers. Raising the wages of low-wage workers. This is a very hot issue for us right now in HEU in British Columbia because we're at the bargaining table fighting for a second contract for our members in Sodexo, Aramark, and Compass. I know in Ontario you call the big three Detroit automakers the big three. Well, we call Sodexo, Aramark, and Compass the big three because they are the biggest service providers on the face of the globe, who've taken over privatized public services, well, right across the globe. So we're at the bargaining table with them now. When 9,000 workers were laid off by the BC government in 2002, 2003, 2004, the biggest mass layoff of women in Canadian history, HEU resolved that not only would we fight that bill in the courts, but we would go out and organize those workers who were hired by the contractors, and we did. And we now represent about 96% of those women, mainly women workers employed by the contractors. We bargained a first contract 3 years ago. The wages at that time were $10 an hour. And through a very tough strike at Sodexo and then setting a pattern with Aramark that got Sodexo settled and then pulling Compass, kicking and screaming to accept that settlement, we negotiated a pattern and wages throughout that contracted out sector up from $10 an hour to $13 an hour. Now that was a big increase, but as we all know, $13 an hour is still poverty level wages. And so, sisters and brothers, we resolved back then that we were going to take on this fight differently, that we were going to initiate a living wage campaign, a community-based living wage campaign, before we got to the bargaining table the next time, and we have indeed done that. And I want to say to you, to everybody in this room, I absolutely believe that the issue of raising the wages of low-paid workers is the fundamental equity issue for our generation. The fundamental equity issue for our generation. Who are these low-paid workers? They are predominantly women. They are workers of color. They are immigrant workers in our province. In other provinces, they are First Nations members. They are people with disabilities. They are young workers. They are part-time workers. They are casual and contingent workers. And they all do work that's absolutely critical in our communities. And raising the wages of low-wage workers is an economic justice issue, it's a social justice issue, but it is also an absolutely critical issue for everybody in our union. Because as you heard someone say eloquently the first night, as long as they are able to keep any group of workers at poverty wages in the sectors where we work or in our communities, it is a way of keeping all of our wages down. And that makes it an issue for the entire trade union movement. That makes it an issue for everybody who believes in fighting against inequality in our society. And it is a battle that unions cannot win alone. It is a battle that unions cannot win alone. Let me tell you how we set out to carry on this battle in British Columbia. The theme for our campaign, you may have seen it. We have green buttons and t-shirts that say it. Work should lift you out of poverty, not keep you there. Work should lift you out of poverty, not keep you there. And there were two key elements to our campaign. The first was building the leadership strength of the workers themselves in the Big Three so that they could go out and build a campaign and tell their stories. Go out and build their campaign and tell their stories. And the second critical element of the campaign was about building alliances for a living wage, especially in the diverse communities from which our members come. The goal of our campaign is to shame health authorities, to shame the provincial government into adopting a policy that says, we will not do business with any contractor in any way, shape, or form that does not pay a living wage to its workers. That's the goal of the living wage campaign. And we're doing that, as I said, first and foremost by our members going out and telling their stories. We began almost 2 years ago building women's leadership in a workshop where these members talked about what does a living wage mean to me? And they posted this up on flip charts and on banners. And then they proceeded to tell their stories. Stories like this. One woman said, I get up in the morning, I go to work, my kids are still in bed. I finish my first job, I go to my second job, by the time I get home, my kids are back in bed. What does a living wage mean to me? I'd get to see my kids. I'd get to see my kids. One brother, a Chilean refugee, many years back, said, you know, I'm not asking for a lot. My daughter, she has tremendous musical talent, tremendous musical talent. I so much want her to be able to take some music lessons. That's what a living wage would mean to me. Another sister from Nanaimo said, when I'm at work every day at the end of a shift, after my coworkers have cleared off the table, the trays from patients and residents, if there's leftover boxes of juice or water or yogurt, they take them off the trays and they take them home for their kids. What a living wage would mean for my coworkers is they'd be able to buy food for their families themselves. And this same woman who told the story, recently, we met with one of the health authorities, and she told her story to them. And she said, you know, I support myself. I can't afford to heat my home. I've bought myself a little cheap electrical heater. And in the winter time, we've had a few occasional real bad winters recently. In the winter time, I move my little electrical heater around with me from room to room, and when I go to bed at night, I hope to God that a fire doesn't start before I wake up. That's what a living wage would mean to me. These are women working full-time in the healthcare system in British Columbia. These are women who are the working poor. They work and live in a province where the premier loves to say, "We have great prosperity. This is the greatest place in the world to live." Well, I can tell you for our members who work for Sodexo, Aramark, and Compass, it is not the greatest place in the world to work. They are the working poor, and in British Columbia, we have the worst child poverty stats of any province in the country. 1 in 5 children is poor. 1 in 5 children is poor, and we know that children are poor because their parents are poor, and increasingly, those parents include the working poor. So these women are telling their stories. We're at the bargaining table soon. And our strategy at the bargaining table is to present our reasoned arguments, but it's also to build the pressure all around the health authorities to adopt a policy for a living wage, to speak truth to power, to go to health authorities, to go to MLAs, to go and build support. I spoke about building alliances, and that's the second major element of this campaign. We've been doing outreach to faith communities. Our members are speaking in mosques and temples and churches and building support. They've built support in the Filipino community, in the Chinese community, in the Indo-Canadian community, where the majority of those members also come from. They built support from some employers who are willing to support a living wage, from social planning councils, from the biggest financial institution in British Columbia, the Van City Credit Union. And the campaign is really growing and is really building. And at the bargaining table, what are we saying? We're saying we need to make major progress towards a living wage in this round of bargaining. And a living wage is both about raising wages, it's also about decent benefit plans, and it's about a pension plan for the first time ever for these women who don't have a pension plan, so they don't have to go from working in a life of poverty to retiring into a life of even more extreme poverty. We certainly have our work cut out for us in attaining a living wage for those members. We still have our work cut out for us in many cases in attaining a living wage for social service workers in the province of British Columbia, as we do for social service workers and childcare workers many, many places across the country. And what we encounter, as many of you no doubt do, what we encounter repeatedly when we go and speak to health authorities is, well, you know, it's somebody else's responsibility. It's somebody else's responsibility. So the health authorities say, you know, it's really up to the contractors to pay a living wage. The contractors say it's up to the health authority. The health authority says, we don't get enough money from the provincial government. We go to the provincial government. They said, the health minister last week, why are you talking to me, Judy? Well, you know, it was your idea. It was your idea to contract out in the first place, and you're the one that has to make sure there's money. And then, of course, they say, no, it's the health authorities. And the health authorities say, no, it's the contractors. Well, you know what we say? We say it's time to stop passing the buck, and it's time to start passing the bucks by paying a living wage to everybody who works in healthcare and all the rest of these low-paid jobs in British Columbia and across the country. It is too soon to know yet what we will be able to achieve for a living wage in this round of bargaining and in this stage of the campaign. Ultimately, the Gordon Campbell government, which is facing an election on May the 12th, will have to decide if they want a strike on the eve of an election, a strike that will remind the people of British Columbia about that dirty, sordid chapter in Gordon Campbell's first term where they laid off 9,000 healthcare workers and privatized all of those jobs. and then had to be told by the Supreme Court of Canada, you cannot violate the charter-protected rights of those workers. So we don't know where we'll end up over the next few months, but what I do know is this, that the gains that we have made towards a living wage for these members will be a direct result of three things. The first is the building of women's leadership amongst the workers of Sodexo, Aramark, and Compass so that they could have the strength and the courage to go out and to tell their stories. And I want to acknowledge some of our members who are here who've been involved in the Living Wage campaign and ask them to please stand. The second key element of any gains that we'll be able to make, I believe, was the commitment of the Hospital Employees Union, its leadership, and its activists to think strategically, to fight smart, and to be willing to take on a campaign like this for a relatively small group, a percentage within our members. And the third absolutely vital element to success will be the broad support and the broad alliances that we've built throughout our community, with women's groups, with various diverse communities, with faith organizations, with equality-seeking groups from all walks of life, and even with some progressive employers. These are alliances and coalitions that we will continue to nurture and build, and that all of us need to continue to nurture and build right across the country. Those alliances in communities with the women's movement were absolutely critical for us winning pay equity in many provinces across the country. The alliances with groups like Action du Travail Femmes in Quebec has been critical in women gaining access to unionized jobs and to non-traditional jobs for women. And throughout our history, it's building that very powerful alliance with our equality-seeking allies in communities that is such a critical element of success. I have no doubt, sisters and brothers, I have absolutely no doubt that eventually, not just in HEU, not just in QP, not just in British Columbia, but from coast to coast to coast, that taking on a battle for equality for the lowest paid workers, taking on the battle for a living wage with all the energy that we can muster, we do absolutely have the ability to take what was a slogan and turn it into a reality that indeed work will lift us out of poverty, not keep you there. That's our challenge. We have to do that together, sisters and brothers. Thank you so much. It's so great to be here at this conference.